All right, everybody, it's 7 o'clock. Let's get started. Good evening and welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Amy and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Amy.
For those of you who wish to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phone. Do I sound like I'm speaking from space?
Yes.
A little bit. Feedback.
At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step one. Please welcome our panel. We have Melissa and Dan. We've got fans. I will read the first paragraph on page XXVI, and then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Page XXVI. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account.
Hey, everybody. My name is Melissa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Melissa.
My sobriety date is September 8th, 2014. I have a home group, Westside Young and Sober. We meet on Tuesday nights at 7:30, right up the street at Trinity Presbyterian. We use the 12 and 12, which is another piece of literature from Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're ever in this direction on Tuesday night at 7:30, come check us out. I have a sponsor. She is aware she sponsors me. That's important because early in my sobriety, that was not the case. I had a sponsor in name only. I don't even think she knew she was my sponsor, but I saw her 4 times a week at my old home group, so that's just in my mind what she was. But I have found it's very critical in working the steps to work them with a sponsor. I tried doing it on my own. I was not successful, probably also because I tried working like the 7 or 8 that I thought applied to me, not all 12. It's generally suggested you do all 12 to have the spiritual awakening that talks about in step 12. But I love the doctor's opinion. I really actually love all of this book. I can't always have said that, but the doctor's opinion is where things started to click for me. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was introduced via a treatment center, which I went to for depression, not because I drank a fifth of vodka and a couple of bottles of wine every single day for about 4 years. That wasn't my problem. My problem was I was just depressed and I couldn't deal with my life. And I just drank to self-medicate, you know, whatever term you want to add to it. I couldn't be an alcoholic because I have never been arrested. I've never gotten a DUI. I've never lost a job. I've never been evicted, lost, you know, any material possessions. But what drove me to seek help was I tried to commit suicide. That's probably not a normal reaction to people with, you know, my situation. So I thought, all right, you know, I drink too much. I can't stop drinking on my own. At that point, I knew. Like, I was physically addicted to alcohol. I would say every morning when I would wake up, I'm not going to drink today. I would, an hour later, be drinking vodka and Red Bull on the way to work because that's the only way that I could calm the shakes down enough to function. If I didn't sustain some sort of level of alcohol in my bloodstream throughout the day, I would be in the bathroom having panic attacks, and I worked in retail. Not exactly conducive to doing a good job. I was physically addicted. I got that, but I didn't understand why. At some point I had lost the power of control. I could no longer decide if I was going to drink or not drink. And I really like the second paragraph where it talks about the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. I looked up, at the urging of my first actual sponsor, the definition of allergy, and it's an abnormal reaction. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. When I put it in my body, I don't know how much I'm gonna drink, and I don't know what's gonna happen as a result of that. I grew up in the Midwest, good old, you know, Midwestern values. I come from a great family. There's no trauma in my past that caused me to become an alcoholic. But when I put alcohol in my body, for whatever reason, the things that I was raised around, the principles that I was raised around, the morals and the principles, those are out the window. It didn't matter at the end how much I said I wasn't going to do this, or I wasn't going to drink and drive. You know, that went out the window. I wasn't going to go home with someone I didn't know in the middle of, you know, leaving. That went out the window because I was a blackout drinker. I had no idea what I was doing. I would wake up in strange places. I remember one Friday night going to do laundry at the Soap and Suds in Ocean View, and woke up the next morning in the hotel room on the naval base. And I wasn't dating anyone in the Navy. And the person I woke up next to, I'd never seen before. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that happened to me when I was drinking. And that's not something that I ever would have done or said I ever would have done if, you know, I hadn't been in a blackout or, you know, under the influence. But the more I read and work the steps and go through these things, the more they finally start to fit into place for me and make sense. Maladjusted to life, in full flight from reality or outright mental defectives are three things I never would have said I was when I was in the middle of it. On the other side of it, I absolutely fit every single one of those categories. And today, there's no embarrassment, there's no shame, there's no remorse for those things. I've gotten it out of me, I've worked the steps, I've, you know, shared that with someone else, and that stuff doesn't hold power over me anymore. You know, I have the ability today to talk about that without any of those negative feelings attached to it, and, you know, that's because I'm able to help somebody else by talking about it. That's the purpose of this, is to be useful to someone else and not be so absorbed with myself anymore. So that's it for now.
Hey, my name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
And my sobriety date is May 1st, 2016. And my home group is Largemont 12 and 12. And I meet actually tonight, Mondays at 8 p.m. If you ever want to come out and join us, do the back-to-back little doubleheader there meetings. It's a good time. We have a good time out there. We work the steps. We help each other out. And it's a good home group. So come check us out. And I do have a sponsor as well. He's aware of me. We actually got together and talked yesterday, mainly about me being selfish and repeating the same bad decisions that I've done in the past, because that doesn't necessarily all change once I become sober and work the steps. That's why this is a process, and I have to keep doing it on a daily basis. And so we talk about that stuff, and that's good. And we talk about, you know, sobriety too, and how we can help other alcoholics. So that's pretty cool too. And that's what I'm here for now. So, and yeah, I didn't think there was anything wrong with me, with my body or my mind or anything when I got in here. I was like, this is a total mistake. You know, those cops shouldn't have arrested me. That was a misunderstanding. I just couldn't explain myself properly. The reason I couldn't explain myself properly was because I was so drunk. I couldn't, you know, communicate. I couldn't talk right. And so of course they're going to be like, all right, this guy needs to, you know, come with us for the night. And so that's what happened, and that's what sent me into the rooms the first time. And I was familiar with AA already. My dad has been sober a long time. He's been in AA a long time, and I thought I knew what AA was. I'm like, I know what that place is. You know, I had been to some meetings when I was a little kid. I remember there was one dude who talked to me about Star Trek, which I was really into at the time. I still like Star Trek. I don't know why I'm saying that. It's still cool to me. But so I remember this dude talked to me, and I was like, oh, that guy's cool. I don't know about the rest of them. You know, even my dad, I was like, well, I don't necessarily like everything my dad is doing. Of course, I never had much experience with my dad being drunk, so I didn't really have anything to compare it with. But he also kind of bribed me into going to Alateen. He would always like say, I'll take you to Cold Stone if you go to Alateen. And so I went there, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I think his just way of like introducing me to, you know, showing up somewhere and sitting in a circle and that kind of thing. So I at least had some idea in my head of, you know, where to go eventually. Although he didn't really put it to me that way, but I kind of see now where it was all kind of, you know, coming together. So that was a thing, and I didn't necessarily think I got a lot out of that, mainly because my dad was fortunately sober. And a lot of the people in there, their family members are still drinking, and I didn't really have a lot of experience with that, so I couldn't really relate. But rather, I would just get frustrated rather than like having some empathy or whatever. I'd just be like, "Can I just get out of here, please?" Because that's my attitude. I don't have a lot of emotional support for other people. I'm just like, "All right, this is inconvenient for me. Goodbye." That's pretty much how it goes a lot of the time, and especially when I'm drinking. Then that's like 100 times worse. And as far as the physical part of it goes, something pretty interesting happened to me before I ever took my first drink. I didn't drink at all in high school. I wouldn't say I behaved myself, but I didn't pick up a drink of alcohol. I found other ways to take out my anger and all my other issues I had going on. But I do remember the night of my high school prom that I had paid one of my friends some money, so someone who was able to get us liquor could get us some liquor, and we were going to go to this hotel room at the oceanfront, and we were all going to party and have a good time after prom. And I had actually broken my big toe doing our senior prank, which was a slip and slide in front of the high school while we were supposed to be in class. That was our senior prank. I'd broken my toe doing that. So I was at prom with that, and then I was making my way down to this hotel room at the oceanfront. So we could get drunk, and I didn't really know what that was like, what that entailed. I'd never really been around that a lot. We didn't really have it in my house. There's no reason to. My mom doesn't drink either. I've seen her have a third of a beer once. And I remember that distinct. I remember where it was. I remember who was there. It's really the weirdest thing, because that's the only time I've ever seen her drink. And I think it's only because my grandpa pressured her into it. So I'm pretty sure that's the only reason. But anyway, so I'm heading down to the, and I get to this hotel room, and I walk in. I'm on crutches. I get in there, and this guy is there, and I don't know. This is my friend's boyfriend, and he's in there mixing drinks, and I don't know this dude. And then I just see all the liquor bottles lined up on the counter, and something just like hits me, and I'm like, I gotta get the hell out of here. And so I just hightail it. It was like a fight or flight thing. I don't know how to explain. It was the weirdest thing. Not the weirdest thing. It was pretty weird, and I'd never experienced that before. And I'd seen, of course, alcohol at restaurants like lined up like that, but it was just like the fact that it was right there and it was accessible, maybe. I don't know. But something was like, and I just hightailed it out of there, and I didn't drink that night. Then, of course, I got drunk the night of my high school graduation, and I was like, well, come on, man. Why didn't I just go for it, the night of the prom? Because it was so much fun, and it was, my first drink was a Mike's Hard Lemonade, and I absolutely loved it. I didn't even realize I was drinking alcohol. I mean, they told me, they're like, yeah, this will get you drunk. Hey, try this. It's good. And I was like, all right. And I was like, it's lemonade. What are you talking about? And then I started to feel something. And I was like, all right, well, I kind of see what they're talking about now. And so that was kind of the end. And I wasn't just like, oh, let me take it easy. And from the first time I was like, oh, I got to have some more of this. Like, this is, I got to have more, now, please. And so I did. I didn't get alcohol poisoning like my friend. My friend actually got taken to the hospital. So I was like, all right, this night was a success, so I can keep doing this. Even though I got in a lot of trouble with my parents, I was throwing up the next day and all this other stuff. I thought I had a tattoo when I woke up in the morning. It was just my friend who had drawn on me. She was a really good artist. And I just looked at it, I was like, oh, how did this happen? I was like, I was actually thought it was kind of cool. And then I was like, oh man, it's not real. Anyway, so I was like, man, I gotta keep doing this, And I didn't know why. And I just think of that whenever we talk about the allergy, and that just makes me think of that night. And from the moment I had that drink, it was just like something in me was like really craving it. And that continued for a long time. And I wouldn't necessarily say I ever became a daily drinker, but there always came a time where I had to have that alcohol. I had to have that drink. The pressure just built up to the point where if I didn't, then something was just gonna happen. And it was just, I felt like my head was gonna explode sometimes if I didn't take that drink, And then once I did, then I don't know what's gonna happen after that. So that's, and it's usually because I'm in full flight from reality, because my reality is pretty terrible. And it's usually my own fault, even though I won't admit it. So we'll talk about that more later.
All right, we're continuing on page XXVIII. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
So this was super important for me, and it took me a minute for this to click, like several other things did, but I didn't understand that I was different in my thought process with alcohol, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Like, I very clearly remember like holidays when I'd be around my family and they'd open a couple of bottles of wine and there'd be like six people and they'd pour glasses of wine for people, and Mine was done before, like, I'd really taken like 3 bites of food and I wanted a refill, and everybody else was nursing it, and then we'd be cleaning up the kitchen afterwards and there'd be these half full glasses of wine, and I was always the one volunteering to do the dishes because I would make sure everything was cleared up, and that meant I was drinking all those leftover, because when I was around my family, they couldn't know I had a problem. They couldn't know that I drank the way that I did, because I had, you know, this appearance that had to be preserved. And, you know, I was doing my level best to hide from them, which eventually turned into I was stashing airplane bottles and wine in cardboard containers in between stacks of towels in my brother's half bath under his stairs, and that's what I would drink throughout the day when I was at my brother's house, the one time a year I would go visit them. And then I would limit the amount of time that I was around my family. Like, I knew I could white knuckle it for a couple of days, but if I wanted to get any sleep, I had to drink to the point of blackout, and I could only last maybe three days, and then I was literally, you didn't want to be around me. I was not a pleasant person to be around when I was at that point. But it's so funny, I spent Thanksgiving at my brother's down in South Carolina a few weeks ago, and we were cleaning up after dinner, and my mom was doing the dishes, and I had cleared the table, and someone had set a glass of wine on the bar, and my mom was like, whose glass is this? And I was like, it's not mine. Like, and I said it completely joking, just, and everybody laughed. You know, I'm a little over 5 years sober, so we're at that point where it's humorous. But in the back of my mind, I was also thinking, like, you guys have no idea. If that were me a few years ago, like, there wouldn't even have been a question, whose glass is this? Because there wouldn't be anything left in it. That's how I know, like, I don't know many other people outside of these rooms that people do that or think to do that. But for me, I don't understand what's the point of drinking a third of a beer. You know, I'll go, my parents retired to Florida a few years ago, and I'll go visit them, and I'll be there for a week, and it'll take them a week to drink a bottle of wine. And I'm like, how can you open it and not finish it? That's my mentality. I don't think along the lines of just one. I think along the lines of, I'm gonna stop when the alcohol runs out, whether mine runs out or yours, I drink all yours too, or I black out. That's when I stop, because like I said, once it goes in me, I have zero control over how much I'm gonna consume and when I'm gonna stop. And again, it just comes back to that allergy. I have an abnormal reaction. A normal drinker can drink one and go on about their business. I could never do that. It's funny, I had no idea that Dan's first drunk was his high school graduation night, because that was mine too, which is kind of an unusual from sitting around the rooms for a while. That's a little unusual, but I was the same way. I got drunk on Boone's Hill and cheap beer, and you know, I threw up, but I didn't think, I'm never doing that again. It was, hey, that made me feel comfortable in my own skin for the first time in my life. It made me feel a part of, like, these were people I'd grown up with and lived with, you know, for my entire life, and I had never felt a part of, but, you know, put a little alcohol in me and that stuff starts to melt away, and, you know, my shoulders start to come down and I start to perk up a little bit and think that I fit in, or, you know, I'm tricking myself into thinking I fit in. That's what alcohol did for me. Thankfully, I have a different solution today to counter all of that. So that's all I've got.
Oh, this was bad news for me. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. I don't want to see that. I don't even want to see it, much less think about what it means. Because that means if I'm an alcoholic, like if they're talking about me in here, that means I can't drink anymore. Mm-hmm. I can't face that, because how am I going to deal with life if that's the case? How am I going to do anything? How am I going to deal with stress or emotions? Or any of it. The great thing that alcohol did for me was that I didn't have to care about any of that. And it just kind of didn't matter anymore. And all I would really think about was all right, how am I going to drink more? How am I going to enhance this and feel, make myself feel good in some other ways too while I'm drinking? And that was pretty much it. And sometimes there, if it was a bad drunk, then there would be thoughts of revenge and, you know, how I was going to get one over on everybody who had supposedly wronged me. That was the other side of it that I didn't want anyone to know about, because I wanted everyone to think I'm the party guy. I'm the guy who has a good time when he's drinking. And sometimes I did. And sometimes I didn't. And I didn't want to let anyone know about the times that I didn't, because then that might mean I can't safely use it. And I didn't understand any of this stuff. If someone had read this, someone probably did read this paragraph. I used to sit in this meeting a lot as a newcomer when I was coming in and out for 2 years. Someone probably sat up here multiple times and read this part of the doctor's opinion, because it's always the same readings. And I probably was just like, it's the phenomenon of craving. I don't get it. And what I think of when I think of the phenomenon of craving is, so I went to ODU and there's this club, I guess you could call it a club. It's kind of a hole in the wall. It's called The Edge. And my friend, okay, someone knows what I'm talking about. All right, cool. So my friend lived in the apartment buildings right behind there. We would walk over there sometimes and go in. And we would drink at his apartment before. That's where the real party was. But we would go over to The Edge and, you know, hang out there also. And so once we got in there, it was a little harder to get alcohol sometimes. Wasn't as easy as being at the apartment where there's plenty of it. And sometimes there's a lot of people at the bar and it's hard to get up there. And I don't maybe have my money with me, or maybe I don't have any money, depending on the night. And so then I'll just go, and people like to leave their bottles and whatever on the side of the, you know, in the back, and the, you know, rested on the little corners. And I'll just go back there and have one, have another, just grab random bottles. And another time, another place I would go was Mojo Bones, and, you know, I would just sit there, and then I don't even think I would ask sometimes. They would just, like, give me the beer. They would just hand me the beers, and they were leaving. I'd be like, hey, man, here you go. I'm not going to finish that. I'm like, all right, cool. That happened at least once. I know that happened once. I remember it. And I was like, how did this dude know? But then I was like, I mean, I drank it, of course. But, I was like, has he seen me here before? Or is he just, like, have an alcoholic radar or something? I was like, what is going on? But that's what the phenomenon of craving is, because if I'm a normal drinker, whatever that is, I don't really know what that is because I'm not one, but I would think that that would be repulsive to me, or I'd be like, well, what if, you know, I could catch some disease or something, you know, what a number of things could happen. Actually, it kind of freaks me out now thinking about it, but when I'm drinking, none of that matters, because the phenomenon of craving takes over and all I care about is getting that next drink, and none of that other stuff matters. And none of that even runs through my head. It's just like, there it is. All right, it's time. And that's all. Because that's really a phenomenon. That's pretty wild to think about, that none of these other considerations, which make a lot of sense, even enter into my mind once I'm, you know, in that grip of that, you know, once, what does it say in here? It says, once I formed the habit. I don't know, man. I formed the habit pretty quickly, I would say, and I really tried to break it. I tried really hard on my own, and I couldn't. And that was a hard thing for me to accept. That's why, like I said, I came in and out of here for 2 years trying to fight against it and not really asking for a lot of, you know, maybe if I would have asked someone what the phenomenon of craving was, maybe they would have told me something I could get down with. But I didn't really want to know the truth, because then I might have to do something about it. That's the bottom line.
So. All right, we're continuing on XXVIII. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
I like to refer to this paragraph as the mic drop paragraph. Because this finally told me why I drank. You know, he's been describing it in the passages before this, but men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It's absolutely true. It erased all of those anxieties and fears and worries and all of that stuff for me until it didn't. It just stopped working. And then at that point, I was screwed. You know, I'm physically addicted to alcohol at that point. I've already said, you know, I thought I was just depressed and that's what the problem was. That's why I tried to take my life. It wasn't the case. And, you know, my experience in inpatient treatment was brief. I was there for 18 days and my insurance company told me I was cured and I could go home. Which I know today I'm never going to be cured of this, and that's okay. And, you know, I came back here and stuck around in meetings for about a month and, like I said, did what I thought I needed to do, and I was good. And I went on about my way, and life was great. I wasn't drinking. I didn't have to go to these meetings all the time. I didn't have to tie up all my time being around all these depressing people who all they sit around and talk about what happened when they drank. It's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was. I hadn't really paid a whole lot of attention the few meetings I did go to. And things were good. And then life happens as life tends to happen. And I didn't know how to deal with it. And my solution was to drink. And so I drank again. It was about 6-7 months after treatment. And after I'd gotten back from treatment. And it scared me enough to where I didn't drink again for about another month. Now, when I did drink, there was no question that I was going to get drunk. Like, I bought 3 bottles of wine. I didn't buy 1 bottle of wine, or I didn't go to a bar or a restaurant and order a single glass of wine or a beer with a meal. Like, my intention was to get drunk. And my alcoholic brain had tricked me into thinking that was me controlling it. I decided I was going to get drunk, so I got drunk. Just as it said, I'm scared of what happened. I knew what happened. I knew that's what I was going to do, so I'm not going to drink again. And I went a whole month before I drank again. And then the next time I drank, it was, I'm just going to have a couple glasses of wine with these coworkers, and that's all I'm going to have. And that's what I did. There goes that alcoholic brain again. I'm now controlling my drinking. There's no way I could actually be an alcoholic. So I've proved myself I was right. I went to treatment because I was depressed, not because I was an alcoholic. Less than 3 weeks later, I was back drinking the way I had been drinking before I went to treatment, and I drank that way for about 2 months and worse. And the lines in the sand that had been there before that I hadn't crossed over, those got crossed over. I used to drink at home all the time. I would drink out socially acceptably, and then I would leave early enough to get home to drink the way that I needed to drink. I'm now not doing that because I have a roommate who knows I'm not supposed to be drinking, so I'm drinking and driving all the time, and I'm out. And, you know, I'm hanging around people I would never hang around, and because I'm using them for what I need. You know, they can drive me. It's not safe for me to be driving sometimes. It's not safe for me to be driving in any of these situations, but, like, you know, I latch on to people that I can manipulate and that I can use to my own end. And that's, you know, again, that phenomenon of craving, it kicked in. And for me, the well-known stages of a spree are not a day or a two-day thing. It's gonna go until I either can't go anymore and either kill myself successfully or finally get that run-in with law enforcement that I've successfully avoided to this point. That's what awaits me if I go back out drinking again. I know that. You know, it's insanity. The things that I did, knowing what was going to happen if I drank, but I had no control. I finally understood what it meant during this time that I had no control of choice over the drink. Once I put that first one in my body, I was done. You know, and I used to say I relapsed. I didn't relapse because I was never sober in the first place. I was dry for several months. And the irritable, restless, and discontent in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober for some time, I can become a dry drunk again. And I have those things pop up again if I'm not staying on my P's and Q's and working my program the way that I need to work my program. And that's completely up to me. But thankfully, I have people in my life today that point that out for me when they see something's off and they know I'm not behaving like my normal self. But before, you know, I had this solution to my drinking problem. It's not a drinking problem, it's a me problem. I just treated it with drinking. I didn't have anyone to check me on that stuff. So it was a free for all, and I never knew what was going to happen. That's all I got.
Yeah. Taking a few drinks. That's the part that I always think about, because in my head, it was always, I'm going to go have 3 or 4 beers. A lot of the time. Sometimes I knew I was going to get blackout drunk. And those were times but other times I was like, man, I'll just have 3 or 4. I did really well on that exam. That didn't happen too often, but when it did, I was also going to get drunk. It took me 7.5 years to finish college. And a lot of it had to do with my drinking, of course. I just loved, you know, I loved that part of college. I didn't necessarily love the part where you had to go to class and do all those things. I eventually figured out that I had to at some point, and so then I was going to class drunk, and that made it a little more entertaining for me sometimes. But anyway, yeah, the time I said I had done really well on the exam, and I was like, oh, I'll have a few beers. That's what other people do when they celebrate these things, and like taking it with impunity. Like it means nothing, like it's like no big deal to them. And they don't get arrested, and they don't have to show up in AA meetings to get their charge dismissed and all these other things. And well, I'll do that this time. And then I go and get blacked out drunk. And then next day I'm like, well, what the hell happened? I said I was going to have 3 or 4, man. What is going on? Because I didn't know the truth from the false. I didn't know I was an alcoholic until later. And that seemed normal. My alcoholic life seemed like the only normal part of my life, or at least the only thing that I could find any relief in. The other parts of my life were bad. I didn't like that. I didn't like the parts of my life that I had to be sober for, or I was supposed to be sober for. And it just did not appeal to me. And when I could get drunk and go out and party and do all that, that's my real life right there. That's, you know, with my friends. And my friends were my friends. Some of them still are my friends. Some of them were my drinking buddies, who a lot of them drank like I did, and I would find them. And some of them were worse than me, or I thought they were at least. In my head, they were worse than me, so that I can look at them and say, oh, I haven't done that yet. I can keep on going. And then it got to the point where no one was really doing the stuff I was doing. And even one day, my mom, literally, I was living with my parents, part of my drinking, she pulled me out of bed because she wasn't going to have my nonsense. And she was like, you're going to work. And I was still stone cold drunk from the night before. And I used to build decks. And it probably was not safe for me to be there. Fortunately, I didn't chop off my fingers or do anything like that. But it was definitely not the greatest day of my life. And I remember being in the car driving because she wasn't going to let me drive. And I was like, well, Mom, aren't you used to this? Like, didn't Dad get up to this kind of? She's like, your father never did any of this, like half of what you're doing. And I was like, oh, man. I was like, oh, that's not good. I didn't like hearing that. I was like, well, he's an alcoholic, and he's been sober for 20 years, and he's not doing the stuff I'm doing. Well, what does that say about me? Then I try and go get drunk again and forget I heard that. But it doesn't work. And that was something that really messed with me a little bit, which is a good thing. The best thing I could do is disturb somebody about their alcoholism. If that's the only thing I do tonight, then I've done my job. Because that might get somebody to think twice. Like, I started thinking twice after being sitting in AA long enough and hearing enough people's experiences. I was like, well, maybe I'm part of this too. Or maybe I just need to do it regardless of what I think or feel about any of it. Because eventually I got to the point in my life where I didn't know if alcohol was going to keep giving me that sense of ease and comfort at once. Because that's really what I wanted at once. I want to feel better at once. So I like that part. I want, you know, immediately. I want it now. And that's why I love drinking so much, because it gives me that. And I love that effect. And I'll chase that to the ends of the earth. But when that's not effective anymore, when there's a doubt in my mind, like my last night of drinking, I didn't get that right away. And actually, at the end of the night, I was drinking and as much as I could and still feeling just as miserable. That's the point I get to where then I say, okay, well, now what do I do? Now my drinking, my alcohol, my only, you know, companion here has deserted me. Now what do I have? And I'm like, oh, God, I have to go back to AA, don't I? Or if I don't have to, but if I don't, then I'm totally screwed. And I finally realized that. And alcohol is just going to keep beating me down with this big hammer. And that's what I've been letting it do to me, just drinking over and in. And then, you know, I finally look up and see the hammer. And I'm like, oh, man. You know, I'm like, well, maybe AA, there is something there. Maybe I just should do it. And I still didn't think it would work, but I'm here, so something worked.
All right, we're going to turn the page over to XXIV. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules.
So this gives you a little foreshadowing of what's to come once you've been through the steps. And it, you know, talks about this entire psychic change. And this is kind of where they're starting to introduce the fact that I can't control this. No human can control this. There's got to be something else out there. When you move on in the steps and you get to 2 and 3, you hear finally the words higher power and God. And, God did not scare me. I didn't not have a relationship with God, but I didn't have a relationship with God. I was kind of indifferent. I did believe there was something out there. But I didn't utilize any part of that until, you know, I came into AA and worked the steps and had this psychic change and this spiritual awakening that led me to where I'm at today. And, you know, having been through that, you know, I seemed doomed. I did. I felt, and, you know, to be honest, my problems were not all that horrible. Like I said, I had very, very, very few consequences. I had not run everyone in my life out of my life. They still wanted me around. God knows why. But they did. And, you know, I had the job. I had the car and the place to live, that sort of thing. But I was an empty shell of a human being. I was just existing. That was about it. And, you know, I didn't think that was a big problem, and it was a big problem. Looking back on it now, like, that's no way to live. And obviously that I didn't want to live that way anymore. That's why I had taken the drastic measure that I had taken. And today, you know, I have all of these spiritual tools that have been laid at my feet. I know I have a physical and a mental disease that's treated with a spiritual solution, and these steps are what give me that solution. You know, alcohol is no longer the solution to those problems. It never really solved them. It put a band-aid on a bullet hole, sort of, with them, but they were still there. They were always still there. Today, that's not the case. You know, I'm able to work through them, you know, that last sentence, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. This isn't a program of action. I don't just get to sit here and get sober by osmosis. That would be great, but I wouldn't get anything out of it that way. I have to do some work. It's not hard work, but I can make it really, really hard for myself by being stubborn, and which, you know, I'm a little bit less stubborn today than I used to be. And that the only reason for that is because I've seen the results. I see what happens when I actually do the work and when I take the actions and what comes from that. And, you know, controlling my desire for alcohol, I have no desire for alcohol today. You know, that's been removed from me. It took a while because I took a while to start working the steps and taking the actions. But once I did get into the steps, into this book with a sponsor, that went away. I can go pretty much anywhere today. And there's alcohol everywhere. I'm never going to be able to hide from it my entire life. That's no way to live either. But I don't have the, you know, I can make that joke at Thanksgiving and actually mean it and actually laugh about it. And it's not a big deal where I'm like a ball of anxiety, like, oh my God, I have to go spend 5 days with my family and I can't drink. Like, that doesn't exist for me today. And that's a freaking miracle. I never, ever thought that I would get to that point in my life. And I have that today. So.
So I'm going to share a little quote here that actually just made me think of, just because someone stumbles and loses their way, it doesn't mean they're lost forever. Now, I know it sounds like some spiritual leader or some really important, it's actually Professor X from X-Men who said that. I really love it, and I think it really works here, because, I know, right? It's her Star Trek and now this. It's crazy. It's all right, X. I embrace it. And so I stumbled a lot. And I definitely lost my way big time, and I really thought I was lost forever. I was like, I'm never going to. What it's talking about in here, that I'll be easily able to control my desire for alcohol, even when I want it. And towards the end, I did want to control. I was done. I did want to stop, and I just couldn't. I know that's what I wanted to do. I just go nuts. Because I just couldn't control it. Even though I really wanted to. And I never thought it would be easy. I didn't think that was going to happen. I definitely had so many problems I despaired of ever solving them, that's for sure. The only way I knew, I didn't know how to solve them. All I knew how to do was drink and try and forget about them. And they were still there the next day, and then there were new problems also that I created while drinking. So that was not effective, but that was really all I had. In my toolbox. My toolbox is pretty... That's funny. I don't know why. I actually had a toolbox and it had a lot of tools in it, but my actual, like, the spiritual tool, you know, that talks about here, that was bone dry. There's nothing in there. Not even the box. I didn't even have a box to put anything in. That's... Because I wasn't willing to do it until I was. Until I really was backed into a corner. And, it reminds me of one of those boxing movies, you know, where Rocky's just getting wailed on by Apollo Creed or whoever, and just in the corner like this, like, you know, and just trying to get out of there and be like, all right, I've had enough finally after, you know, whatever, 10 rounds or, I don't know, boxing, so I don't know how many rounds are supposed to be. Anyway, that might have not been the best one to pick, but it's okay, because you all get it. The image is the important thing. That's what alcohol was doing to me. It was just pummeling me. It just had me in the corner against the ropes there, and I just didn't know what I could do about it. And what I had to do about it was follow a few simple rules. I had to work the steps with my sponsor out of this big book here. And that did give me a psychic change, which, that sounds kind of weird. All it means to me is that I don't think the same way I used to. And I don't know how that happened. It happened somewhere in the process of working these steps and continuing to pass it along to others. But I don't think the same. And I know, because things that I thought about when I was drunk, I think about now, and it's just confusing to me. And I don't think I'm a different person. I know that drunk Dan is still in there, and if I pick up the first drink, he'll come right back out. You know, that's still a part of me, but I think the thought patterns are different now, and that's what's been given to me through the steps. And I don't have that obsession anymore. That has been removed, and I didn't think that was possible. Even when I came back in here and started actually doing it for real and really trying, I did, still didn't think it was going to work, but I just had no other way to go. And I really feel fortunate that it did. I think I've gotten a lot of chances to make another attempt that not everyone gets. So it's really a pretty cool thing, and I'm just glad I'm here today.
All right, our last reading is on page XXX. All these, and many others, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
So, again, he talks about the allergy, and these and many others he's talking about are the different types of alcoholic that he's described here. And this is also where I stopped comparing myself out and trying to relate in. You know, I couldn't come into the rooms and sit and listen to one person and be like, oh my gosh, they're exactly who I am. Like, that's not my experience, but I did listen enough to where I started being like, oh my gosh, I could pull from this person and that person and be like, I did that. And it made me, for the first time in my life, feel a part of, like, I fit in somewhere. I didn't want to fit in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's for sure, but hey, that's where I fit finally. And now on the other side of that, I'm so grateful I fit in here, because I know what's wrong with me and I know what to do to help keep that at bay. This is a lifetime thing, a lifetime process. It's not hard. I can make it really, really difficult for myself sometimes, but in reality, it's not. And, you know, the last sentence, their only relief is to suggest entire abstinence. Again, there is no cure for this. It is something that I will have my entire life, as long as I can continue to believe that I have it my entire life. The only treatment for it is the steps. It's spiritual for me. It's a spiritual treatment. The steps, relying on a higher power to keep that at bay, and I just have to do the work and let God work through me, and I will hopefully continue to stay this way until I'm 6 feet under. So, thanks.
Yeah, I really thought I could drink without developing the phenomenon of craving, even though I didn't know that's what it was. I was like, yeah, I can totally do that. I can. One time, me and my friends were watching the Redskins in the playoffs. I know this is a while ago. One of the only times in the past 20 years they've been in the playoffs. So you probably know exactly what year I'm talking about. Anyway, they lost. But I was drinking. They're not heavy. They're normal drinkers. They had like a beer. And then someone had two. And I was like, okay, good. I can have two now. Someone else did it. And then I was like, all right. Well, this didn't set off anything. And this is all right. And then I don't think it was that night, but very soon after that, I was back at the bar drinking. And that's the phenomenon. Like, it doesn't set it off right away sometimes. It's the weird thing. I can do that and have the two beers. But then at some point, what I really want to do is get blackout drunk and just drink as much as I can. And that's what it's talking about. It doesn't say it's right away immediately once I take the first drink. It could be delayed. And sometimes it was right away, and sometimes it was a little more insidious, and it would creep up and be like, all right, now we're gonna get drunk. I'm like, what, really now? All right. And because once I take the first one, there's nothing I can really do about it. And that, this part, I really, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And I'm like, yeah, right, where's the other part that says how I can drink how I want and not get in trouble? And it's not in here. It was very unfortunate for me, because I was really looking for that. But yeah, the only way that has been effective for me is just to stay away from it. And there has been times where where it has come back. Not for long, but it comes like that. Those thoughts, and it'll come back into my head, and it comes back. But I know what to do about it now. I know I can go to a meeting that I need to let someone know about that. You know, no matter how long I've been sober, it doesn't matter. If I can be like, hey man, I was thinking about this today. I was at this show, and I was like, man, I used to drink all the time at shows, and you know, wouldn't it be nice to just enjoy this with a beer? But I know the truth about myself now. I can differentiate the truth from the false. It's one of the gifts of this program, and I know it wouldn't just be a beer. And I have tools now, my toolbox, I have tools now that I can use. And the most important thing I can do is try and be helpful to another alcoholic in these rooms that's feeling the same way I felt. And that's why it's important to remember how I felt back then, especially when I wanted to stop and couldn't. Because that's the place where I can be most helpful in sharing my experience. So that's it.
All right, we're going to pass the baskets in accordance with the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it did previously. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you.
Welcome.
Literature is available on the table to my right. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you would like to purchase a big book. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, can we please thank Melissa and Dan again? Good job. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. It's right up Colonial Avenue, right past 21st Street. And will someone volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? BJ, Nicole, someone.
I'm BJ, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, BJ.
Hey, BJ.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right, we have a nice way of closing. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.